Good morning. Three quarters of Americans say democracy is under serious threat. Almost as many say politically motivated violence is a major problem. We'll have the results of a new NPR PBS Marist poll on Morning Edition from NPR News. Zoran Mamdani is headed to the November election for New York City mayor. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We'll hear from Mamdani about his plan for the city, how he would pay for it, and whether he was surprised by bigoted responses to his campaign. Also, U.S. cuts to foreign aid spending could cause 14 million preventable deaths in just 5 years, and why Texas is betting on nuclear power as AI data centers demand more energy from the grid. It's Tuesday, July 1st. On this day in 1867, several British colonies were combined into Canada, now called Canada Day. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate is closing in on nearly 24 hours worth of debate over the multi-trillion dollar tax cut and spending bill. It's favored by President Trump. Republican leaders can only lose 3 GOP votes or the mammoth measure will fail in the Senate. 2 Republicans are opposed, one because it doesn't cut enough government spending. NPR's Elena Moore says the other Republicans are worried that the bill cuts too deeply into Medicaid.
You know, they say it could seriously hurt, for one, rural hospitals. But at the same time, there's a group of, you know, hard right fiscal conservatives who still want to see more cuts to the program because they say it'll help the government just offset the costs of this big bill.
NPR's Elena Moore reporting. Billionaire Elon Musk is still angry over the spending bill. He again wrote online that he is open to creating a new political party. Musk says he'll then back primary challengers against any Republican who votes for this spending bill. President Trump is now suggesting online that the federal government should look at cutting subsidies to Musk's companies to save money. President Trump is lifting sanctions on Syria. He says this is to help promote stability in the region after years of dictatorship, civil war, and economic turmoil. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has more.
President Trump announced back in May that he would be lifting sanctions on Syria to give the country's interim president, a former al-Qaeda militant, a chance to turn the page. Administration officials say that his latest executive order follows through on that pledge, dismantling the Syria sanctions program while keeping in place sanctions on former President Bashar al-Assad and his associates. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt says President Trump is committed to supporting a Syria that is, quote, stable, unified, and at peace with itself and its neighbors. She wouldn't comment on efforts to get Syria to normalize ties with Israel. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Authorities in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, have identified the deceased suspect whom they believe started a wildfire in order to ambush firefighters. NPR's Kirk Siegler reports 2 firefighters were fatally shot and another was critically injured.
Kootenai County Sheriff Robert Norris confirmed the gunman was 20-year-old Wes Rowley, who had moved to North Idaho recently from Arizona. At a news conference, Norris said local police had 5 interactions with Rowley before Sunday's fatal ambush, but all were minor for trespassing and welfare checks.
At this time, we can't locate a criminal record for this individual. We had interactions with him, but we don't find a criminal record with him.
Norris says they've also not found any evidence of what he called a manifesto, but the sheriff confirmed reports that Rowley had wanted to work in the forest and be a firefighter. Kirk Siegler, NPR News, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
And you're listening to NPR News. The Trump administration is suing Los Angeles, claiming the city has blocked its ability to enforce federal immigration law. Some LA City Council members are saying this lawsuit is baseless. Scientists have found that many people are what they call dippers. After a meal or a snack, their blood sugar rises high and then plummets quickly below their baseline levels. As Michaeline Dukleff explains, these dips can trigger people to overeat.
The study took place at King's College London and involved thousands of people wearing glucose monitors. After a dip in their blood sugar, people ate about 300 extra calories on average. The dips also coincided with moodiness. People felt tired, less alert, anxious, or angry. To prevent these dips, dietitian Dahlia Perlman at Stanford University says, don't eat carbohydrates alone.
Don't eat naked carbs. Eat them with some protein, some healthy fats.
And more fiber. She also says to eat the protein and fat first. carbs last. Finally, don't eat a bunch of carbohydrates at once. Sprinkle them across several meals. For NPR News, I'm Mikeline Duclef.
The National Weather Service has issued heat cautions for much of the West today. Temperatures could hit triple digits from the upper Pacific Northwest to the Arizona desert. Powerful heat is also gripping Europe. Temperatures will soar in France and other countries to above 100 degrees. Several countries are now opening cooling centers. European weather forecasters say the strong heat is linked to human-caused climate change. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Oscar Wilde, Irishman, dramatist, poet, bon vivant, and hotel snob. In 1882, Wilde undertook a lecture tour of America. The 27-year-old dandy was here to educate the young nation on things often neglected in its race to industrialize: beauty and the arts. March 16th, he gave a talk on the decorative arts at Minneapolis's Academy of Music. A journalist decided to swing round to visit Wilde at his hotel, the Nicollet House, and found the poet lounging on a fur robe, dressed in black velvet, tight pantaloons, and brown stockings. A sight that the man described as quite too utterly utter. Wilde himself was not short on opinions. The champion of arts complained of his lodgings, drab furnishings. He never returned to Minnesota, but maybe that was because he was too busy writing classics, like The Picture of Dorian Gray, and The Importance of Being Earnest.
Well, I must say, Algie, I think it is high time Mr. Bunbury made up his mind whether he was going to live or die.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Leila Fadel in New York City. Good morning. When Zohran Mamdani announced his candidacy for New York City mayor last year, it's fair to say most people didn't know who he was and didn't think he had a chance. He's a democratic socialist, he's young, he's Muslim of Indian descent, and he didn't have the backing of his party's establishment. The New York Times editorial board urged voters not to vote for the 33-year-old, citing inexperience and pie-in-the-sky proposals. And even though Mamdani has kept affordability at the center of his campaign, others tried to define his identity with claims he would promote Islamic law, that he supports terrorism, that he's an anti-Semite.
I think there are a lot of concerns that are based upon a caricature of myself. And I don't blame New Yorkers for having that caricature, because they've had to deal with more than $30 million of spending that paints me in that manner, that smears and slanders me, that artificially lengthens the color and the length of my beard, that calls me a monster.
New Yorkers, for the most part, didn't buy it. Mamdani became the presumptive winner of the Democratic primary last week and is now one step closer to becoming mayor of the nation's largest city. I sat down with him on Monday here in New York City and asked him what his party's leaders can learn from his win.
New York was the state that swung most towards Donald Trump, 11 and a half points. And that swing happened in the hearts of immigrant New York City. And when I went to Fordham Road in the Bronx, when I went to Hillside Avenue in Queens a few days after that election, and I asked Democrats, who did you vote for and why? They told me again and again they voted for Donald Trump because they remembered being able to afford their life 4 years ago more than they could today. And I asked them, what would it take to bring you back? And they said, a relentless focus on an economic agenda.
Let's talk about your policies, because one of the criticisms that your detractors have is that it sounds great to have free childcare and free buses and groceries that you can afford, but a lot of what you're promising is out of the mayor's hand. It's something that will have to happen at the state level. It will have to happen with other actors. So how can you actually fulfill any of these promises?
Any mayor that has an ambition that meets the scale of the crisis of the people that they're seeking to represent will have to work with Albany. And the reason that I put forward this agenda is not only because it's urgent, but because it's feasible. And I say say that to you as an assembly member who won the first fare free bus pilot in New York City, who saw that it wasn't simply about economic relief, it's also about public safety. The fact that assaults on bus drivers went down by 38.9% through this pilot. The fact that we actually saw an increase in riders who had previously been driving a car or taking a taxi. These are the reasons why we pursue this agenda. This is why we believe we can actually do it.
The way that you say you're going to pay for these programs is by increasing the taxes on corporations and then also an income tax on anybody who makes over $1 million, right?
Yes, 2%. The top 1% of New Yorkers.
So again, that's a non-starter for the governor, Kathy Hochul, that she said that. So how are you going to pay for it?
I've appreciated my conversations with the governor. And one thing that I really appreciate about Kathy Hochul is she is laser focused on affordability. And what we've seen is that these policies I'm speaking to you about, they are not just policies that people are voting for incidentally while they're voting for me. They're voting for this platform.
But again, what makes you confident when you're hearing the governor say it's a non-starter? She hasn't also endorsed you yet, as these other leaders within your party have not done.
The experience that I've had. You know, over this campaign, there was a time when many of the ideas we were putting forward were considered to be distinct to our campaign. And yet as we built it, more and more candidates started to embrace those same policies. And I am confident of seeing that happen across the political spectrum. Even Andrew Cuomo said that he wanted to explore making buses free. That was a recognition of the popularity of that as a proposal.
You made some waves this weekend when you said that you didn't believe that billionaires had the right to exist. What does that mean?
I was speaking about the stark nature of income inequality in this city and in this country. And ultimately, I think the better question is whether working people have the right to exist. Because what we've seen in this city is that more and more working people are being pushed out. And the vision that I'm speaking about, it's a vision that I want everyone to enjoy and benefit from, including billionaires. Though my taxes that I'm proposing are ones that would be on the top 1% of New Yorkers, on the most profitable corporations, it's not taxes that will detract from their life. It's in fact taxes that will benefit everyone across the city, including those who are being taxed. And ultimately, this is an interest in finding revenue to pay for something that will transform life in the city.
So you weren't proposing that your policies would ultimately lead to a New York with no billionaires?
No, that's not what I was proposing.
You are going to have what looks like a tough race in November. You already have people like billionaire Bill Ackman saying he'll give hundreds of millions of dollars to anybody who runs against you.
I think he also said some nice things about me as well.
What else did he say?
I think he said that I was smart, which I appreciated. Thank you, Bill.
Well, okay. But he also doesn't want you to be mayor of New York City. You know, and there are other corporations, wealthy New Yorkers who feel the same way. And there are some people who fear your candidacy. You have a support among some Jewish voters, and you have some Jewish voters who are extremely skeptical of you and afraid of your candidacy.
My job is to lead this entire city. My job is to address those very concerns that New Yorkers may have, be it for whatever basis. My commitment is now to have meetings with New Yorkers who may be concerned. Maybe it's, you know, a business leader who is worried about the impact of my tax proposals, and I get to share the fact that these are proposals that will make it easier for them to attract and retain talent. If I can speak with a Jewish New Yorker who's concerned about the issue of anti-Semitism, and I can share the fact that this is a real crisis that we have to tackle, and one that I'm committed to doing so through increased funding for actually preventing hate crimes across the city, and make it clear time and again that my commitment is to protect Jewish New Yorkers and that I will live up to that commitment through my actions. And that's what these next many months are about.
You know, the thing that was very clear in the weeks before and the days after the primary was this barrage of racist anti-Muslim attacks on you, equating you to a terrorist, saying you're a danger to the safety of Americans, especially Jewish Americans. And I'm going to repeat some of the attacks, not because I think they're okay to say, but I want listeners to understand what's being said. And it's not just from the right wing and Republicans in office. It's also from other influential figures. Deborah Messing of Will and Grace posted online that you sided with terrorists and you celebrated 9/11. You were 9 when that happened. Republican Representative Nancy Mace posted a picture of you in your Eid outfit and wrote, "After 9/11, we said, never forget. I think we sadly have forgotten." Republican Representative Andy Ogle called you Little Muhammad and said you need to be deported and is calling for your denaturalization. Were you prepared for this level of bigotry?
It's unsurprising, and yet it's still deeply saddening. As many Muslims in this country know, to exist in public life is to have to deal with this kind of slander at a different scale. And it's part of why so many have thought that the safest place to live is in the shadows. And so much of my hope for this campaign was to bring the margins of our city into the mainstream. It's been very difficult to see just how much of this hatred has been normalized. And as you've said, it's not just Republican congresspeople. It's an actress of a show that I used to watch as a kid. And I think that ultimately my responsibility is to show that our vision for this city, it's a vision that is universal. It's a vision that wants to recognize the belonging of each and every New Yorker. And it's in stark contrast to this exclusionary vision that we see from so many. One that seeks to distract people from an inability to take care of working people by designating the enemies as the other. One of the most difficult parts of this, however, have been that the threats that have been made on my life and on people that I love are ones that fundamentally transform how you can live. And
so it's changed how you can live?
It has. It has. The fact that I now have to have security at all times. It's a different way of engaging with the world. But my responsibility is to showcase that this is but a drop in the bucket of how people actually feel in this city. You know, just a few days after I received a number of death threats and someone who said that he was going to blow up my car, which was news to me because I don't own a car. I walked the length of Manhattan to speak to New Yorkers. And I did it because I think that the way that we defeat this bigotry is by showcasing just how small of a minority it actually represents.
Sohran Mamdani, presumptive Democratic nominee for mayor in New York City. Thank you for sitting down with us.
Thank you so much.
In the country's second largest city, the U.S. Department of Justice is suing Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass and city legislators over L.A. sanctuary city laws. The Trump administration says Los Angeles is making it more difficult for the federal government to enforce its immigration laws. Steve Futterman reports from L.A.
It was back in April that President Trump signed an executive order going after sanctuary jurisdictions.
And it will direct the Attorney General and Secretary of Homeland Security to publish a list of state and local jurisdictions that obstruct the enforcement of federal immigration laws.
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt made the announcement. Standing right next to her, Border Czar Tom Homan raised the specter of filing lawsuits.
I mean, the law is clear, and they're violating it, and this administration will take action.
The Justice Department says Los Angeles is obstructing the federal government's ability to enforce the law. The lawsuit argues that the city's, quote, refusal to cooperate with federal immigration authorities has led to lawlessness, rioting, looting, and vandalism, end quote. City Councilman Hugo Soto Martinez represents parts of L.A. where many people without legal status live. He feels the administration is intentionally focusing on Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think it's very clear to me that they are seeing Los Angeles as a place where they can test everything that they can. The lawsuits included the National Guard, the Marines, the tactics. They are using as a laboratory.
LA's policy prevents city resources from being used for immigration enforcement. Mayor Bass did not comment. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
people of Northern Minnesota that power KAXE.
I'm a member because I feel a sense of belonging being part of KAXE, because I know that they are representing me and the communities and people in our area and the work that we're doing in such a truthful and honest way. I love being able to share it nationally and tell people I've met across the nation, like, you can understand more about what it's like to live in Northern Minnesota by listening online. There's so much that is of value to people anywhere. It's just an honor to contribute and be part of it.
Help us out. Tell us why you are a member. Text us at 218-326-1234 and keep KAXE powered. We're independent, we're local, we're not run by corporations, the government, or a national network. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
Comes from the station and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. In the battle between the Trump administration and the world's wealthiest university, Harvard could lose even more federal funding. A federal investigation says the school violated civil rights law by failing to protect Jewish students on campus. Here's NPR's Alyssa Nadworny.
In a letter summarizing the findings, the Trump administration told Harvard they had been, quote, deliberately indifferent, and in some cases, quote, a willful participant in anti-Semitic harassment of Jewish students, faculty, and staff. The investigation, which was released on Monday, was conducted by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights, and its findings outline the violations that occurred on campus since October 7th, 2023.
It seems that HHS is attempting to ramp up pressure ahead of a possible settlement with Harvard.
Carl Tobias is a law professor at the University of Richmond in Virginia. He points out that the findings come after President Trump said on social media that a deal between the university and the administration was in the works. The federal investigation released this week cites examples of Jewish and Israeli students being harassed, campus vandalism, and examples of the university failing to punish students and groups who violated codes of conduct. The report says its findings show a pattern of, quote, unlawful and unchecked discrimination. In a statement, a Harvard spokesperson said the university is far from indifferent and strongly disagrees with the government's findings. The school pointed to a number of steps it has taken to better protect against anti-Semitism and support Jewish students, including updating its campus rules, reviewing discipline policies, and expanding training on anti-Semitism across campus. Harvard has admitted it needs work on this issue. Earlier this year, the school's own task force found many opportunities for improvement. That report was cited heavily in the Federal Review released Monday. But the administration says Harvard has done too little, too late to remedy violations, and the next step is for the U.S. Department of Justice to take up the issue. Meanwhile, negotiations between the school and the Trump administration continue to avoid Harvard losing more federal funding. It's already had more than $2 billion frozen and is currently suing the administration. A hearing for that case is set for later in July. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
The boom in AI data centers is demanding more energy from utility companies. In Texas, state leaders are betting nuclear power can become a model for the rest of the country. KUT's Mos Buchel reports.
On a recent afternoon, Matt Lozak, CEO of Allo Atomics, walked me through his company's cavernous Austin manufacturing space, showing off the small nuclear reactors that he hopes will be the future of electricity.
Right now, we're coming up to the reactor vessel.
It's a steel cylinder about the size of a small shipping container. Next to it, more metal components, the guts of the reactor.
So this is where the nuclear fuel would go.
And to be clear, there's none of that here today. These modular reactors, he calls them microreactors, are in their testing phase. But they are a key part of the built-to-order nuclear power plants that this startup wants to mass-produce Henry Ford style and sell to AI data centers.
So this is essentially the world's first factory that can output nuclear power plants kind of wholesale.
And he says there's nowhere he'd rather be doing it than in Texas. That's thanks in part to welcoming state policy.
It is time for Texas to lead a nuclear power renaissance in the United States of America.
Early this year, Governor Greg Abbott kicked off the state legislative session with calls to jumpstart the nuclear industry. Texas is the only state with its own power grid. Right now, about 10% of the energy on the grid comes from nuclear. But a forecast from the grid operator had found that energy demand could almost double here by 2030, in large part because of all those data centers. Analysts warned if that forecast is even close to accurate, it could pose a threat to energy reliability.
We must add more power this session to better fortify our grid.
So lawmakers passed the Texas Nuclear Deployment Act. The law creates a state office to promote the industry and sets aside $350 million for public financing. There could be a lot of competition for that. Commercial small reactor projects are already being planned outside Dallas and along the Gulf Coast. Even former Texas Governor Rick Perry is getting into the act. A company co-founded by Perry recently announced plans for what could become the world's largest nuclear-powered AI data center outside of Amarillo. But not everybody is enthusiastic. Diane Wilson is a fourth-generation shrimper and environmental activist in the Gulf Coast town of Seadrift. When she heard about plans for a nuclear-powered plant in her town, she was outraged.
Nobody has bothered to talk to people who might have some concerns, like the fishermen.
She says she's seen too much pollution to want radioactive material used or stored in Seadrift.
We are a fishing community. One accident can wipe us out.
But even putting aside expected local resistance, some say nuclear energy is simply not ready to answer a looming power crunch in Texas and beyond.
I'm not afraid of the technology. I'm afraid of the cost of the technology.
Dennis Walmsted is an analyst with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. He says nuclear plants are notorious for cost overruns and construction delays. While those are problems that small modular reactors are supposed to solve, Walmsted points out they have never actually been deployed commercially in the U.S.
So we don't actually know how long it's going to take. Until you build one or five, you don't know how long it's going to take. Because, like I said, you haven't built one.
Back at the Allo Atomics facility in Austin, a machine on the shop floor kicks on. CEO Matt Lozak talks about plans to start building a working test reactor in the next 12 months. He's confident his company can build one, and then a lot more, with support from state government and deep-pocketed tech firms.
The amazingly fortunate thing is right now, we have that type of demand for the first time, really, since the creation of nuclear energy.
Actually delivering electricity, that's still years away. But Lozak's betting that demand will still be there when the reactors are ready. For NPR News, I'm Mose Bouchel in Austin.
This is NPR News.
Comedian and TV writer Tamara Yahia spent her early years bouncing between Argentina and America and feeling lost.
I had no friends, I had no confidence, and I discovered Madonna on TV, and I wanted to be Madonna.
I'm Elsa Chang, how a kooky family, the material girl, and a life split between two worlds set her on a path towards failed childhood stardom. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Tuesday Morning Show. Coming up in just a few moments, it is our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer will look back at his nature notes for this date, July 1st. And coming up at about 6:45, we'll hear some phenology talkbacks, and then 7:20, John will have his full phenology report, his latest nature observations. You can let us know what you've been seeing in nature. Text in 218-326-1234. Our weather today, mostly sunny skies, highs in the low to mid 80s with west winds 5 to 20. And for tonight, we do have a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly cloudy, lows in the upper 50s. For Wednesday, we have a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly sunny, highs in the mid 80s. And looking ahead to Thursday, it should be sunny with highs again in the low to mid 80s. The Grand Rapids YMCA has a free Forever Well picnic for older adults tomorrow from 11 to 1. And the Bemidji JC's 81st Annual Water Carnival starts tomorrow with fireworks Wednesday at dusk, the Grand Parade Sunday, July 6th at 1 p.m. Find a full schedule of events at BemidjiJCs.com. They have had to make some location adjustments due to the storm in Bemidji, but you can find full details again at BemidjiJCs.com. And you can find a comprehensive guide to the 4th up north at KAXC.org. Find full listings of fireworks and parades activities throughout northern Minnesota. Again, that's at KAXC.org. If we happen to be missing your town's celebration, you can email news@KAXC.org. Thank you for listening to KAXC this morning. It is time now for our daily dose of phenology. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, July the 1st, in the year 2004, I note that among the declining bird songs, there is one that perseveres and strikes a careful note in my ear, a lovely note, and that is the song of the white-throated sparrow. As you can hear, this is an easily recognizable song. Oh, sweet Canada, 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 he seems to say. And with each breath, he enlightens and enlivens the day. And he'll continue to do that for a while. And then, like most of the birds of this area, his song will fall silent. But that won't be the end of him. He will spend some time around your yard if you have a bit of millet to throw out on the ground. He will be there until well into the fall, when he will finish up his dining by eating the last of the northern holly berries before departing for the south.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, presenting Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the scandalous true story of England's infamous Mitford sisters. Streaming this and more original series at BritBox.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in New York.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Ahead of the Independence Day holiday and the country's 249th birthday, three quarters of Americans say democracy is under serious threat.
That's according to a new poll from NPR, PBS News, and Marist. A similar number also see politically motivated violence as a major problem.
NPR political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro is here to talk about these results, as well as the general atmosphere around politics in this country right now. Good morning, Domenico.
Hey there.
So let's start with this question about the state of democracy. What did the poll ask, and what stood out to you about the answers?
The overwhelming majority, 76%, see the country under serious threat. That includes 89% of Democrats, 80% of independents, and 57% of Republicans. And this is coming at a time of great political volatility in the country. People are polarized and sharply divided, so in many ways they're living in different realities about what they perceive to be the threat, regardless of who's right or wrong here. Democrats see Trump and right-wing extremism as the threat. Republicans, though, were 31 points more likely to say that there was a serious threat to democracy when Democrat Joe Biden was president.
So, you know, we have to talk about political violence in this country. There were threats on President Trump's life earlier during the campaign season, two of them, in fact. And over the weekend, there was a funeral for the state lawmaker and her husband who were killed in Minnesota. So how are Americans seeing these attacks?
Yeah, here again, a significant majority, 73%, said they see politically motivated violence as a major problem. While there was little difference by political party, there was some division by race and age. Latinos, black voters, and younger voters, for example, were less likely to say politically motivated violence was a major problem as compared to white and older voters. And one other thing stood out here, on both questions, it was white women, regardless of education level, who were most likely to say that there was a serious threat to democracy and that politically motivated violence was a major problem.
That's interesting. So given all that, what does the poll tell us about faith in political leaders?
It's not great. I mean, people have very low confidence generally in the political leadership in the country right now, whether it's President Trump, congressional Republicans, or congressional Democrats. You know, first, when it comes to Trump, he gets just a 43% approval. And when digging down to key specific issue areas, he doesn't score very well on any of them. I mean, his handling of immigration is 43%. Foreign policy, just 41%. And his handling of the economy is worst of all at 39%.
And what about faith in the political parties?
Well, looking at Republicans in Congress, only 35% said they approve of the job they're doing. And guess what? That's the highest that Marist has recorded since it started asking the question back in 2011. Democrats, meanwhile, who are hoping to capitalize on Trump's relative unpopularity, plus the unpopularity of his mega bill that's making its way through Congress, are facing record lows. Just 27% approve of congressional Democrats. That's their lowest score in 7 years, back to 2018. And the reason for that is Democrats themselves. Only 44% of Democrats say that they approve of their party's approach in Congress right now. Compare that to 73% of Republicans who said so of their own party. If Democrats hope to take back the House next year, they got a lot of work to do to shore up their own House first.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome.
And if you want to dive deep into all of the numbers in the poll, they are on our website, npr.org.
A new study estimates that the U.S. Agency for International Development has helped save more than 90 million lives in the past two decades. This on the agency's last official day.
And yes, when the Trump administration took office in January, one of its first major moves was dismantling USAID. Today, nearly 6 months later, the agency officially shuts down. A few hundred remaining employees will merge their operations under the State Department.
NPR's Fatima Tanis has been covering this and joins us now. Good morning, Fatima.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, so tell us what the last days at USAID have been like.
It's been very difficult for agency staff who've been saying goodbye to their colleagues last week. There have been lots of tears. People told me it's hitting them that this is the end. They said they were drawn to the agency's mission, to the idea of helping people in countries all over the world. You know, they brought up the USAID logo, which was on everything from clinics to food and medical packages, the words from the American people. And that was something staff said they really believed in.
So Fatima, without USAID, is U.S. foreign assistance just something of the past now?
You know, a quick reminder, the U.S. was the largest donor of global health and development funding. Much of that was done through USAID, which managed thousands of programs. More than 80% of them are now terminated. The administration has decided some will continue and the State Department will take on managing those starting today. The administration has made it clear it believes most of U.S. foreign aid has not been aligned with President Trump's America First policy, but it has not outlined a vision for the future.
And what's the impact been of shutting down USAID?
It's hard to overstate. You know, we're talking about cuts to thousands of programs in low-income countries that addressed health issues like malaria and HIV/AIDS, also humanitarian efforts such as feeding malnourished children. We also know that the shutting down of programs has caused deaths. For example, we reported on one child in Nigeria who died because the USAID-funded clinic he went to for urgent medical treatment was shut down. It was the only clinic nearby. And you mentioned earlier that study published in The Lancet, it projects that the cuts to USAID could result in 14 million preventable deaths by 2030. And while much of the impact has been felt globally, there's concern in academic circles and in Congress that there will be consequences felt here at home.
And what are those consequences?
So this actually came up at a hearing last week. Senators questioned Russell Vogt about the cuts to foreign assistance. He's the director of the Office of Management and Budget for the White House. Several Republicans brought up that foreign assistance served two purposes. It helped prevent diseases from reaching the United States, and also something called soft power, where you spend money to build positive relationships and create stability in the world. Here's Republican Senator Mitch McConnell talking about it.
Over my years in the Senate, the biggest supporters of soft power I've run into have been the military generals, who are fully aware of how much more costly it is to have a war than to prevent one.
McConnell went on to say that he also didn't like all of USAID's programs, but that the way the administration had gone after them had been, quote, unnecessarily chaotic and created opportunities for China to fill the gap the U.S. has left.
That's NPR's Fatma Tanis. Thank you, Fatma.
Thank you.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, as Israel bombed Iran for 12 days last month, internet outages left many in Iran with almost no information. The story of one woman, alone and scared, who turned to ChatGPT. Listen on your smart speaker, on the radio, or in the NPR app. This is NPR News.
It is 5:42. You're listening to People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. John Latimer will be joining me next hour. We'll have talkbacks. It's always great to hear from our listeners about what you're seeing in nature. You can text in at 218-326-1234. We hope to hear from some students this week. And then at 7:20, John Latimer's full phenology report. In the 8 o'clock hour, Tornado Bob will have the big weather picture, and then we will be talking with Mike Lynch of Forest Stewards Guild. We'll hear about the recently completed Forestry for Minnesota Birds project. Programming on KAXE KBXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Nearly 300,000 veterans call Minnesota home. If you or a loved one are a Minnesota veteran, you can learn more about the benefits and services you have earned. Link Vet is available 7 days a week via phone, email, or online chat. Information online at linkvet.org. Our weather today, sunny skies with highs in the low to mid 80s, winds from the west 5 to 20. We have a slight chance of showers overnight with lows in the upper 50s, and for tomorrow, 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, otherwise mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 80s. Remember, Lake Bemidji State Park has reopened after storm damage, but many hiking trails remain closed. They do hope to have the Bog Walk open by the 4th of July.
So much for listening to KAXE KBXE. My name is Heather Johnson, and I'm the membership coordinator here. If you're enjoying our music, news, phonology updates, and conversations, consider supporting the station by becoming a KAXE KBXE member today.
Do you have questions about membership? We offer many options for making your contribution. I would love to chat with you. Give me a call at 218-326-1234. Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Total Wine and More, for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at totalwine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. The aquifer that makes agriculture in the Great Plains possible is running out of water, primarily from over-irrigation. That has farmers considering different crops. Kaylin Moore of the Kansas News Service reports.
Western Kansas is sprawling with grain crops, small towns, and essential food and fuel industries. Even hundreds of miles away, ingredients grown in western Kansas are part of everyday life. I'm in rural southwest Kansas, but I asked my coworker Stephen Caranda on the other side of the state near Kansas City to see what he could find at his local grocery store.
All right, I'm going to grab a cart and head on in.
And right away, he started noticing things that were likely from western Kansas.
Whole wheat bread.
Wheat is one of the big ones.
Into the meat section. Oof, lots of beef.
That's very likely from western Kansas, too, one of the country's top beef producers. The list goes on. Soybean oil, corn syrup, milk. All of these products rely on irrigation, which allows dry western Kansas, a state prone to drought, to grow corn, soybeans, and other commodity crops at a large scale. And it's not just Kansas, but a lot of Nebraska and Texas corn crops depend on irrigation. Logan Simon, agronomist for Kansas State University, says that might need to change since the water of the aquifer is tapped at a rate much faster than it can naturally be replenished. So he's been researching alternative crops.
All of the crops that we're looking at here are going to be providing some sort of benefit in the form of a reduction in the water required.
It's not a simple task. Grain elevators and feedlots are built for crops like corn and soybeans, which require billions of gallons of water from irrigation, not per year, but per day. The Ogallala Aquifer, the only source of water for this region, has been running dry for decades due to excessive irrigation for crops that need more water than the region receives. It means some areas in Kansas may only have a couple decades of water left. Alex Miller-Shasky is a young farmer in southwest Kansas, and his water supplies have plummeted.
We used to have 20-some wells on the farm, and we're only pumping 4 now.
For farmers like Miller-Shasky, getting creative will keep their farms going. He's been attending an alternative crop school run by Kansas State University. It focuses on crops like canola, black-eyed peas, and cotton as alternatives that grow well here. Southwest Kansas farmer Heath Kane has bought in. He decided for the first time to grow something he's never grown before, a canola crop.
The wheat price was terrible, and I have got some limited irrigation, and I was like, well, I wanted to like kind of diversify some of that and not just have all my eggs in one basket.
Growing canola requires about 40% less water than corn, and new biofuel markets fueled by canola have recently spread to Kansas. So if these alternative crops can solve so many problems on the frontier, why don't all farmers just make the switch?
You have to be willing to accept more risk to establish that alternative crop, because there aren't these built-in mechanisms that we usually have.
Agriculture economist Chad Hart from Iowa State University explains that commodity crops like corn and soybeans are the most economically efficient despite their water costs. Plus, crop insurance, government subsidies, and bank loans are all built on traditional crops, not the possible alternatives. Those dollars make up nearly a quarter of a farmer's income.
They insure not only crop farm yields, but they also insure the prices that the farmers will capture.
But despite the risks, the next generation of farmers seem intrigued by the challenge of growing something new. For NPR News, I'm Kaylin Moore in Liberal, Kansas.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Pam Perry from Brainerd is a regular contributor to the KAXE Morning Show. She talks about birds and other wildlife. We asked her why she supports this station.
So, and now the most recent thing is the newsroom. And I love the news reports. You're not hearing that anywhere else. You're not hearing about what county boards are doing and local governments. This is the place. This is where you're going to hear about it. And the music was wonderful. You know, and you had your volunteer hosts. And again, local people often. I want to support it. I want to support something. And then, of course, when I was listening, I was going, where else do you hear about bud break and plants and birds and forestry and all the things that, you know, were northern Minnesota?
You can become a member like Pam Perry. Give now at KAXE.org.
On this Tuesday morning, no big vote yet in the Senate on that whopper of a tax cut and spending bill.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at Viking.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. In the Senate, they've been churning through amendments like short order cooks and a 24-hour greasy spoon. Marketplace's senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Adams is following all this. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Again, Votorama, what have our senators been doing all night?
So as part of the rules of reconciliation, which is what's letting the GOP pass this bill without Democratic votes, senators can offer unlimited amendments. But the debate on each one is really short, like 10 minutes. So this gives senators a chance to change components of the bill, but it's also used as a messaging tool.
All right. So like speed dating, but with implications for 30 and 40 years. What are some of the amendments that have come up, Kimberly?
Democratic senators have been very clear that they're offering amendments that even if they know they're going to fail, they will highlight components of the bill that they think are harmful, especially cuts to social programs like Medicaid and SNAP. But some Republicans offered amendments as well. For example, Maine Senator Susan Collins had a failed amendment that would have increased the size of a proposed rural hospital fund and pay for it by raising taxes on higher incomes. But one successful amendment that passed 99-1 this morning removes a provision in the bill that would have banned states from regulating AI for a decade.
Okay, so AI and Republicans have the potential to pass the legislation without any votes from Democrats, but can only lose 3 votes in the Senate. What are some of the key sticking points that we're all watching for from GOP senators?
Yeah, some senators are really worried about those Medicaid cuts. The Congressional Budget Office estimates the Senate version of the bill would result in almost 12 million people losing insurance over about a decade. And Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina has already said he'll vote no because of that. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul says he'll vote no because of how much the bill would add to the deficit. And there are holdouts on other issues that could turn out to be that third vote.
Now, even if the Senate does go for this, many issues are already causing problems with the House of Representatives, but especially the deficit.
Right. The Senate GOP used some, shall we say, unique accounting measures to reduce the cost on paper of this bill from more than $4 trillion to about $440 billion. And fiscal hawks in the House are very much not on board with that. So it's definitely going to be an issue, even if the Senate Republicans can get this passed. House Republicans are also worried about the Senate's more severe cuts to Medicaid than their version, as well as harsher rollbacks of green energy tax credits.
All right. Green tax credits, Medicaid, a lot more. Marketplace's senior Washington correspondent, Kimberly Adams, thank you.
You're welcome.
The S&P 500 stock index ended up 10.6% for the March to June quarter just ended. The NASDAQ went up 17.7% during all the tariff changes and inflation and recession talk. The U.S. dollar index is down 11.8% in the first half of the year. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
Oxford Economics says the dollar is down around 10% since January, and it expects the greenback to continue losing value next year and in 2027. Oxford says talk of the dollar losing its status as the world's reserve currency is premature. Still, investors are cautious amid all the uncertainty caused by President Trump's trade war. There are fears that import taxes could drive up inflation, causing the Fed to keep interest rates higher for longer and slowing the economy. The S&P and NASDAQ, on the other hand, closed at record highs yesterday. Investors are happy that tariffs haven't caused inflation to spike yet. Tech stocks are gaining ground as traders bet on advances in AI. All eyes will be on this week's jobs report on Thursday as traders look for signs that the job market is still healthy. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This morning, S&P futures are down 0.2%. NASDAQ futures are down 0.3%. And the New York Times shopping advice outlet called Wirecutter has been looking for the effect of tariffs on, tariffs off on 40 of the products they've evaluated. The upshot is a lot of prices have not changed yet. An ASICS cheapo laptop got 7% more expensive, and a Cuisinart kettle went up 20%. But an IKEA sofa stayed flat, as did Graza olive oil and Earth-rated doggy poop bag. A strange one was a South Korean-made LG French door fridge. Wirecutter found the list price went up 39%, but its retail sale price stayed flat. Note that the comparison was mid-April to mid-June, and we may need to check back in late summer for medium-term tariff to consumer effects.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com.
Today we'll get figures for new vehicle sales covering June as the Senate works on pulling federal tax credits for electric cars and a surprise proposal to raise the tax on new wind and solar projects. It is an uncertain time for electric vehicle buyers and makers. That said, a firm called QuantumScape, backed by Volkswagen, announced what it says is a major breakthrough in battery production, solid state. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino explains.
Batteries need electrolytes to move ions between two electrodes. And in current EV batteries, those electrolytes are liquid or gel.
The material that is used as that electrolyte contains oxygen and it's combustible.
Sam Abu El-Samed at automotive market research firm Telemetry says even though EVs ignite less often than gas cars, the fires are harder to put out. Solid-state batteries significantly reduce that risk. They're also more energy dense.
You can have double the capacity, double the range.
Sounds pretty great, right? So why haven't we switched? Well, solid electrolytes present some manufacturing challenges, says Armugam Mentiram, an engineering professor at UT Austin.
The solid electrolytes are all ceramic. They're very brittle. They're not flexible. They can crack.
Building large ceramic pieces that are thin, flat, and uniform is tough at scale. But QuantumScape says it's improved its process to make these ceramic parts and plans to start selling solid-state batteries to companies like Volkswagen by next year. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Our producers are Ariana Rosas and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Alex Schroeder. Our supervising senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It is just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition, and then John Latimer and I will have our student phonology talkbacks at 6:45. You can let us know what you've been seeing in nature. Text us 218-326-1234. Support comes from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Mostly sunny today, highs in the low to mid 80s, winds from the west 5 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight we have a slight chance of showers with lows in the upper 50s, and for tomorrow we have